Hello and welcome to the Guardian Film Show, and congratulations, you may have won $1 million. To collect your prize, you need to join us on a road trip through this week's cinematic releases. Buckle up, hunker down, terms and conditions will always apply. Rumbling out with us tonight, Daniel Radcliffe gets solid beat as Allen Ginsberg in Kill Your Darlings. Spike Lee hopes to get squids in with his remake of the cult favourite Old Boy. And the skateboarding kids of East Germany pull tricks behind the wall in This Ain't California. But first to Nebraska, where director Alexander Payne has Woody, played by Bruce Dern, chasing down a fortune won via a postal lottery. Payne's film tells a loving tale of America on the slide, and Zambrook's headed into the heartland to meet him.
How did you and Mom end up getting married?
She wanted to.
You didn't?
I figured what the hell.
Were you ever sorry you married her?
All the time. Could have been worse.
Well, you must have been in love. At least at first.
Never came up.
I'm just always so desperate to find a book or a screenplay or something which can even just barely get me over the line of qualifying to be a movie, because I'm always so anxious to shoot. I liked the austerity of the story. I liked the sense of humor. I liked that it was set in my beloved home state of Nebraska, and it would allow me to be in the rural areas that I don't know very well. I wanted to make it in black and white, and I'd always been looking for a film that I could make in black and white. I thought this was a perfect candidate. The father-son theme, the road trip, that's all kind of secondary. I'm not denying that those elements are there. They certainly are. But I don't know, sometimes when I'm picking a story, it's like, oh, that could make a good movie. It's just a very instinctive thing.
Hey there, Woody, remember me? Bernie Bowen, how you doing?
Pretty good.
Well, that's what I hear. Everybody's saying how Woody Grant's a millionaire. Well, that's the most exciting news around here for ages.
That's no big deal.
No big deal? Jeez, there's a guy living a life for Riley. Million here, a million there. Well, the newspaper's gonna do a big write-up on you.
Do you see it as a political film?
Marxists would say all film is political, even in its avoidance of politics. Yeah, it could be. Sure, it could be.
It paints a pretty bleak view of...
Yes, it does have a fairly bleak view.
Unrecognized, ignored middle America. That we don't really...
Yeah, but it's not entirely bleak.
No?
I think it has a loving view as well of the characters. But I... Again, it's not for me to comment on the themes or the vision, if there is one at all in the film, but I think there's a certain sadness and melancholy, if not bleakness, about it.
Come on, let me take you home.
Going to Lincoln. It's the last thing I do. I don't care what you people think.
Listen to me. You didn't win anything. It's a complete scam, so you got to stop this, okay?
I'm running out of time.
You didn't even have a suitcase.
I'm not staying there.
Dad. I can't let you go.
It's none of your business.
Yes, it is. I'm your son.
Well, then why don't you take me?
I can't just drop everything and drive to Lincoln, Nebraska.
Oh, what else you got going on?
Joining me now are our own pair of hopeless dreamers. It's Peter Bradshaw and Andrew Pulver. Peter, we saw in the interview with Alexander Payne that he's quite evasive about this film. He doesn't really want to give much up about the vision of it. What did you take from it?
I took from it that he is becoming a real poet of the road movie. I mean, this is his third road movie. I wonder if he quite realizes quite how at home he's becoming in this genre, but he's certainly made it live. I mean, I'm not a big fan of the road movie generally, but this is really good. I think it's such a sweet-natured film. It's got such a gentleness. It really handles the bittersweet quality of it, the pathos and the regret. And it's an absolute masterpiece from Bruce Dern, who is obviously he's been a figure in independent cinema, for especially American independent cinema, for such a long time. In fact, I think recalls some of the work of those directors that he was once associated with, particularly people like Bob Raffleson. That really is really, really good. I loved it. It just gave me such a warm feeling.
Payne took a lot of trouble to film this in black and white, and he got some heat with the studio for doing so. What do you think it brings to it?
I think it brings a kind of plainness and an austerity to it. The cinematographer said his model was Bogdanovich's The Last Picture Show, And it really does bring that to mind, I think. Now he's said that, it really brings it to mind. It's one of those things I forget after a while that it's in black and white after a while. It's like watching Raging Bull. I just forgot after a while that it was in black and white. I just went with it. And I thought it gives it a kind of classic feel. Sometimes you think, is this going to be entirely earned, this attempt at classic status? But I think it sort of is, sort of is.
There's a great love as well for Middle America in this. He's obviously a big fan of his home state.
Yes, he really is. He is very much at home in what media sophisticates sometimes call the flyover states. He thinks this is his homeland, his heartland. I was reminded, I think it was Gilbert Adair who said that John Sayles was a director who could approach America without making it look like Hollywood. He sort of somehow managed to subtract the Hollywood from America and make you see it afresh as just like any other North American country, for example, or any other country. And I think Alexander Payne has something of the same thing. That's what I kind of love about him.
Is there a danger with that? Because, I mean, he's dealing with very rural, quite poor communities here, and he is the urbane, sophisticated director who escaped that and has a house in LA. Is there a danger that he's almost looking down on this?
I didn't feel that. Well? I didn't get condescension from it. If anything, I got a kind of detachment. I got the fact that as the filmmaker, is a night's move away from these people. But I got detachment and I got a sort of objectivity, but also I got a kind of affection as well.
I thought you drank. Come on. Have a beer with your old man. Be somebody.
I've been trying to give it up.
What for?
I mean, it was starting to... It just wasn't helping.
Now you're all right.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
Can I have a beer too, please?
You betcha.
I'm gonna drink with my dad.
That's Bruce Dern and Will Forte chucking back a cold one in Nebraska. Now to a time when the music soared, the typewriters sang, and Harry Potter cruised the gay scene. Kill Your Darling sees Daniel Radcliffe play Allen Ginsberg, and it bops and swings like this.
You want life? You want the world on fire?
Security?
What the hell are you doing?
Where's the threat?
And you are?
Allen Ginsberg.
Are you a writer?
No, I'm not.
Well, you're not anything yet.
There's still a worldwide epidemic of people not being able to... feeling comfortable saying how they truly feel about things and being able to really express themselves in a very free way. So I think that when you go back to the origins of the first people to really kind of do that in a way, like that's something that people still latch on to, like the whole like naked self-expression of it all.
The death of morality.
Sudden bouts of blindness and a severe decline in moral standards.
Welcome to the edge of the world.
My English teacher used to say to me, there's two types of poets. There are people who write poetically about their lives, and there are people who live poetically and write about it. And I think the Beats did that. There was this kind of abandon and this wildness and this refusal to accept the traditions of what's gone before that you kind of find in lots of countercultural movements. Sort of, you know, punk is the one that I think of in the 70s in England. It brings to mind, and it's that same sort of vibrant energy that even if you don't like what they wrote, you kind of like what they stand for and the way they went about writing it.
Where are you going?
You know me now. I'm only good at beginnings.
You're dropping out?
These guys were the original hipsters, and there's a huge, that's obviously come back in a huge way now. Like where I live in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, I can't walk down the street without passing at least five people that are dressed exactly like Jack Kerouac. So it's not only their poetry that has persisted, but it's, you know, their style and what they stood for and their lifestyle and all that stuff I still think is extremely relevant.
Andrew, it's easy to romanticise the Beats on film. Do you think this film does that?
I've got to say, I like this film quite a lot. I think it's fairly clear that American cinema is very, very keen to make films about the Beats because it's their sort of great poetic modernist movement. And they've tried quite often and never really got there. I always sort of think the best films, the best Beat characters are often sort of comedies like Peggy Sue Got Married. Like, is that great? guy Michael, who's the sort of Polo Neck beat poet guy, because I suppose it's very difficult to film ecstatic visionaries in a very straight-faced way. And I think the approach that Kill Your Darlings took was quite a smart one, which is to sort of focus on Ginsberg, who's the sort of naive one who isn't really yet a fully formed ecstatic visionary, and he's sort of looking a bit saucer-eyed at the sort of cool kids who are. And also because it also concentrates on this sort of real-life kind of murder-killing case. It has one or two scenes of sort of crazy beat action, but not that much. Mm. And I mean, that's where I think films like On the Road kind of went kind of wrong by taking all
they try and steep you in this heady atmosphere of the Beats being a crazy, crazy.
I mean, it's
kook,
the thing to do if you're sort of making a film about the Beats to try and sort of summon up what they were feeling and going through. But it's like filming people who are drunk. You know, the drunk people love it, but watching is not that interesting, is it?
Peter, this is a part of a trio of films that was presented in Toronto, presented as Daniel Radcliffe growing up and becoming a new actor after Harry Potter and maybe after The Woman in Black as well. Do you think he convinces?
Yes, I do. I do. I think this is what makes this a kind of cut above the other Beat films we've been watching, at least partly, is because his performance is very distinctive and intelligent, and it's bold stuff. It's bold stuff. He's talking about Ginsberg's sense of self and his sexuality, and Radcliffe goes for it. He really does go for it in a very big way. And you can see him growing as an actor, really, all on screen. He just sort of flowers, I think. So, yeah, I was very impressed by him. I'm still a bit agnostic about Beat films, which tend to be very precious, I think. Although I think this is interesting in that it's talking about the dirty little secret of the Beat generation, and there was this horrible act of violence that they were all in flight from. And it has the very interesting sense that the whole of the Beat movement is a way of absorbing and reimagining this terrible thing that happened, and kind of reconfiguring it in the context of their own daring kind of transgression. So I thought it had a very interesting point to make.
How does it compare to Howl, which was the last kind of Ginsberg film that James Franco saw?
I thought it was much better. I think he is much better than James Franco. I like James Franco, but sometimes James Franco can be unbearably mannered, whereas Radcliffe really isn't. He's absolutely without affectation as an actor, in a way. He really is very candid and ingenuous in his address to the camera, whereas Franco, I felt, just was so self-conscious.
It's always an art project with that.
Yeah,
it
is a bit. It is a little bit, yeah.
This is just the beginning, you know.
You don't know Lou. As soon as you think you do, he'll find someone else. Maybe he already has.
He is a professor who won't let me go.
Let's get rid of him.
We're going to make sure nobody remembers him.
Bang!
The best minds of their generation having a right old laugh destroying themselves there. Next up, a documentary about East Germans skateboarding in the shadow of the Berlin Wall. Here's This Ain't California. Martin Purcell's sort of documentary makes the GDR-RAD. A skateboard is snuck into East Germany. A group of friends take it and turn it into a tool for revolution. Reams and reams of gnarly archive footage take us to the rebellious teen's political awakening. It's almost too good to be true. Peter, let's get the veracity thing out of the way first.
Yes.
You watch this film and you're amazed by the Super 8 footage they somehow dug up from the past.
I was amazed I realised there is something tricky going on.
They've staged a lot of it.
They have staged a lot of it. As far as I can see, I can't really put my hand on my heart and pinpoint something which they haven't staged. Mm. I mean, I think there is a valid and legitimate debate to be had about this film and about the new approaches to factual filmmaking generally. I don't have any knowledge of the East German skateboarding scene which exists independently of this film. So it's very disconcerting to find out that everything that I know is based on this film, and that's maybe not true. All of the Super 8 footage is staged. As far as I can see, there is no clear indication as to who its lead character was, this guy Panic. He may have been real. He may have been a composite. He may have been an out-and-out invention. So there is something exasperating and a bit infuriating about this film, and it sort of turned me against it a bit, even though I found the ideas in it fascinating. I like the idea of the skateboarding scene in East Germany having an individualist ethos which helped to undermine the granite monolithic quality of Erich Honecker and the East German regime.
But isn't that an ideal that seems too neat in itself, in that they've kind of plonked it on the film?
I didn't mind it. Well, it is a bit of a plonked ideal, but I like the idea of the brutalist architecture actually facilitating the skateboarding. Again, I liked it. As I say, now I'm not sure whether it's true or not, but I still liked it. But I felt I'd been led up the garden path.
And yeah, Andrew, it would have made a really good feature, something like a Goodbye Lenin-style, you know,
yeah,
drama.
I think it's possible to take a sort of intellectual position on the sort of fictiveness of it all, yeah, and sort of think, well, the filmmakers are playing with all these sort of notions of truth and fiction, and sort of somehow conceive it as a sort of situationist entity, if you want, whether or not they were sort of hoping to sort of get it past people and then sort of a year later say, we fooled you all, or not. I don't know, or whether the whole thing was conceived as an elaborate fiction. And you know, they stuck it in documentary film festivals and won awards for it. So they weren't, you know, they were sort of playing this deceptive card straight away, I think. As a fake doc, it doesn't go too far with its sort of superficial. I mean, obviously, when you see a lot of films that are faked, you kind of think it's just literally impossible this could have happened. They couldn't have had five cameras on one thing. They don't make that mistake, for example, that they, everything does seem to be filmed with one Super 8 camera from one angle, and then they stop and, you know, cut and.
And also, if you're going to fake anything, like, yeah, you'd think that skateboard videos are the thing to do,
yeah,
because there's a comparable thing between the Super 8 footage they have,
absolutely,
and,
yeah,
you know, a really cheap skate video that a load of teens have filmed on a budget.
Yeah.
I mean, the big comparison that a lot of people make is the Dogtown and Z-Boys documentary, which now I'm thinking, Christ, was that all made up too?
Yeah.
I don't know. But obviously, they studied that pretty hard.
It's left us questioning if anything, yeah, ever really happened.
I know. Nanook of the North, I mean, that, yeah, had reconstructions, yeah, in. I mean, that's the debate that they would come back with and say, yeah, well, look, let's not be naive. All of these things, you know, to turn a camera on something is to start creating some sort of fictional entity. And I get that, and I get the idea that they might be playing with truth and fiction, but that's not what comes across from the movie. That's not, people don't go away thinking, yeah, it's interesting, the nature of truth or untruth. They, yeah, say, wow, isn't it interesting about that East German skater? And then to be told, actually, no, it didn't really exist. All of our interest in the film, all of our investment of attention in the film is premised on the idea that we are seeing something real, something unusual and real that we didn't know about before. And to be told at the end, to have the mat pulled out from under our feet, that actually, no, it's not, I think it's a little bit worrying.
Seeing is believing with This Ain't California. Our final film is Spike Lee's remake of Park Chan-wook's Old Boy. Josh Brolin plays our morally dubious ad exec. Let's see how he handles the octopus.
The fuck is the phone? Hello? Hello?
You know how it goes. You have too much to drink and wake up with a splitting headache, locked in a room, where a faceless psychopath will keep you hostage for 20 years before releasing you to enact your bloody revenge. Josh Brolin plays our luckless reveller. Somebody get that man a couple of decades worth of Alka-Seltzer.
Your father's been missing for 20 years. If I could somehow bring him here, do you think you could forgive him?
I could try.
Andrew, second time around for Old Boy, and what's Spike Lee added?
I can't say he's added a huge amount, actually. So I think, in all honesty, it seems to be taken quite a lot away. I mean, I can't say I'm an absolute massive fan of the original Korean sort of stuff anyway, but I just think this was a very, very glum, violent film that sort of didn't really have any of the sort of berserk grandeur of if that's what you call it, of Park Chan-wook's thing. I don't know, it just seems sort of really, even these elaborate fight scenes just seem so sort of boringly staged and just hitting somebody with a hammer and wandering off. You know, it just didn't really have anything for me, really.
It seems like a strange choice for Spike Lee to do this now, particularly since Park Chan-wook is a stylist. He might not like him, but
yeah,
he has a very distinctive style, and Spike probably doesn't in that same way.
No, anyway. I still don't know. I've run it through my head a million times, but why Spike Lee? Why does he want to do this? I don't know. Maybe it was just something set up for him. It was a gig he took and he thought he could bring to it some of his own kind of muscular qualities of urban life, blah, blah, blah. And I think he did, in a way. It's a very efficient, has a very efficient kind of replica qualities. But what he missed, I think, in Old Boy is the kind of crazy, bizarre black comedy. Mm. That's what that kind of tang of horrifying bad taste comedy, that sort of mad, crazy laughter you can, as it were, hear from Park behind the camera. And he missed it entirely. And he sort of fudges one of the great scenes, which is the octopus scene. I mean, that's such a huge scene. And that is the most famous scene in Old Boy. And you think, well, what's he going to do with it? How is Spike Lee going to do this? What's he going to, how is he going to, is it going to be 10 octopuses? Is it going to be a whale? Or what, you know, what's it going to be? And, well, not to give anything away, he fudges it and muffs it, really. I thought it completely kind of lost it. That was such a bad thing for him to miss, I think, for him to have no ideas about what to do. Yeah. It's pretty efficient. If you've never seen the original, this would kind of freak you out in the same way that the original freaked us all out. I was absolutely freaked out 10 years ago when this came out. I just thought I'd never seen anything like it, even though I knew a little bit about Park Chan-wook's work. And then it's the same old story. Why are you remaking something which was still relatively recent?
It's particularly strange for me because, I mean, Old Boy, you can stream it now on Love Film, Netflix, iTunes, all of that. So these films are more and more available now in their original form. Yeah. And I guess the thinking is trying to pick up on that cult feeling of you may have seen Old Boy, but you may not be interested in the American version.
They would say, look, of course you can stream it, but subtitled movies don't play. You know, this is an English language movie with a big Josh Brolin and Elizabeth Olsen. Of course, this is going to be more accessible to an English-speaking American multiplex audience. And I get that, and it's done efficiently, and you know, well, it's a workmanlike job of work. But why, when it doesn't have, it misses out so much of the stylistic craziness and the crackling evil weirdness of it. It just seems to miss it out.
I only run this place, all right? Shit, you might want to think about what you're doing here.
I've been thinking about it for the last 20 years.
Josh Brolin hammering home the realities of remake culture in Old Boy there. And that's it from us. My thanks very much to Peter and Andrew for joining me. My thanks to you for watching. I'm afraid if you've watched to this point, your ticket is now null and void, but please do join us again for the draw next week.